This is the tax update for January the 20th, 2009. Sharing the credit, the IRS rules on a Section 38 provision for unmarried taxpayers. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying on the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio file. Such prohibited use including this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. The IRS recently issued IRS Notice 2009-12, which provides guidance on splitting up the first-time homebuyers credit that was added by the Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008. One somewhat unusual provision in that credit is the ability for individuals that jointly own and use the property who are not married to divide up the credit. The IRS this week granted what most observers saw as a very favorable set of rules that allowed splitting the credit up on taxpayer-favorable terms. The first-time homebuyer's credit is found in Section 36 of the Code. Provision allows a credit equal to 10% of the purchase price of the residence for a first-time homebuyer if the property is used as a principal residence. Under that provision, a first-time homebuyer is defined to mean a person who has had no present ownership interest in a principal residence during the three-year period ending on the date of the purchase of that principal residence. The term principal residence shares the same meaning that it has for Section 121's gain exclusion provision. Other restrictions are imposed on the credit to limit or eliminate the use of the credit for property acquired by certain parties, acquired by gift, and in certain other cases. The credit is also eventually phased out and goes away as the income increases. The limits defined in Section 36(b)(2), and generally for unmarried taxpayers, the credit goes away as their income goes over $75,000. And for married taxpayers, it goes away as their income goes over $150,000. And that credit is reduced by the amount, according to the code, which bears the same ratio to the amount which is allowable as the excess over that limited amount to $20,000. So if we're $10,000 over the limit, we lose half of the credit. Modified adjusted gross income, which is our limiting factor in this case, is defined to mean the AGI increased by the amount excluded for the income under the sections 911, 931, or 933. Now, a number of other special features apply to this credit we're not going to deal with in the presentation, such as its ability to apply the credit against your 2008 taxes even if you're closing on the home in 2009 prior to the expiration date of this provision. The fact that credit is really not so much a credit as an interest-free loan that's going to be repaid over 15 years when you cease to use the property as a principal residence, and certain other special features that go in with this bill. Rather, we want to concentrate on that one area the IRS looked at this week, which is the provision found in Section 36(b)(1)(c) that provides a special case for individuals who are not married and purchase a residence. That provision provides that if two or more individuals who are not married purchase a principal residence, the amount of the credit allowed under this provision shall be allocated among the individuals in such a manner as the secretary may prescribe, except that the total amount of the credits allowed shall not exceed $7,500. Without the provision, it would appear that we would have gotten $7,500 for each of these individuals potentially, so we could have had a multiplier effect on the cost of the house with multiple individuals and a rather significant marriage penalty. But even in this case, it appears with what we're going to be given as our fix, it appears that this provision still has built into it now a marriage penalty of a sort, as we'll discuss as we go forward. The how of couples split this credit has been answered by the IRS in this notice, and the answers are relatively generous to the taxpayer under Notice 2009-12. They're so generous that, as noted, this really indicates that we have, again, a kind of a minor marriage penalty in play here for the first-time homebuyer's credit, because we have cases where we could not get all the credit or where we couldn't even potentially get any of the credit, that we're now going to be allowed to use this provision to essentially recover the full value of the credit in many cases if we can file as single individuals. The actual IRS ruling is rather short on how you split the credit. In fact, it's a very short ruling per se. Most of the ruling's taken up with examples explaining how it's applied. The ruling simply says that the taxpayers are allowed to split the credit using any reasonable method they choose to. That is, a reasonable method is defined as any method that does not allocate any portion of the credit to a taxpayer not eligible to claim that portion. Now, that's not the clearest wording in the world, but it appears to basically state that we cannot, you know, it reminds us that even if we allocate $7,500 to somebody, if they're over the income limit, they're not going to be able to claim that whole credit. But if you read it literally, it seems to virtually force the credit onto the eligible partner's return. It certainly seems to be able to read it that way. If we had one partner that was eligible and another that was not eligible, that it would be forced onto the eligible partner's return. We're also told specifically that a reasonable method includes, but may not be limited to, I would presumably, due to the wording, the following items. We could divide the credit based upon the taxpayer's contributions toward the purchase price of a residence as tenant in common or joint tenants, or it could be divided based on their ownership interest in a residence as tenants in common. Or, as I noted, presumably, some other method, and in fact the examples talk about doing it certain other ways. The meat of this proposal is actually found in the 7 examples that the IRS gives explaining the provision, and they're interesting to look at because they give some insight into how the IRS views the application of this, what is clearly allowable, and maybe some of the limits the IRS sees on what's allowed under this provision. Example 1 deals with uneven contributions to a purchase price, that is, where one individual contributes more than the other, but we end up owning half of the property each. In example 1, A contributes $45,000 and B contributes $15,000 toward the purchase price of a residence. So A is paid 75% of the cost and B is paid 25%. Each of them, however, ends up on title with a one-half interest in the residence as tenants in common. The example goes on to note that the credit's limited to 10% of the purchase price or $6,000. It then holds that A and B may allocate the $6,000 credit 3/4 to A and 1/4 to B based on their contributions. Well, okay, that makes sense. But also goes on to note that it could easily also be allocated 1/2 to each based on their ownership interest in the residence or using any other method and says, for example, the entire credit to A or B because both A and B are eligible to claim the entire allowable credit. RIA's daily newsletter this week noted that what that didn't discuss was there a gift that had taken place underlying this? And the gift raises 2 questions, actually, if there was a gift in play. First, obviously, there'd be a potential gift tax consequence. Well, that arguably isn't relevant for 2009-12 because it's not talking about that. But secondly, Code Section 36 limits our ability to get this credit if we acquire property by gift, indirectly, we should say, because it provides that if we acquire property where our basis is given by reference to the basis of the original holder or someone else, we're not allowed to claim the credit. Clearly, if B suddenly now has a 50% interest in this residence, B's basis in the residence is going to be based upon half of A's original contribution. That is, he'll have a $30,000 basis and a 1/2 interest. $15,000 of that essentially came from a gift from A. But the IRS under this ruling states that in this particular fact pattern, there's no problem with that gift losing us the credit. In example 3, they're going to make clear how we can end up with a problem that comes forth from that and how we can blow it with a gift. But in this case, where both were involved in the purchase and they gave unequal amounts, the IRS sees no problem in allocating the credit pretty much however we wish, including 100% to the lower contributing partner. Example 2 deals with what is a case that probably we do see quite often. We have an unmarried couple. One party makes the actual down payment, scrapes up the cash for that. The other party has no cash currently. They're both liable on the mortgage. So in this case, they put 10% down on a $100,000 purchase price of a residence, and they're jointly liable for the $90,000 mortgage payment. Each of them owns a 1/2 interest in the residence as tenant in common. The IRS notes for us that because the purchase price was $100,000, we don't get $10,000 for a credit, but we have to limit that to $7,500. We can allocate that $7,500. They note again 55% to A and 45% to B because that's their contribution to the purchase price. We can allocate it one half to each based on ownership interest or using any other reasonable method and again moving the entire credit to either A or B. Again, we are not required to have the majority of the credit go to A even though A supplied more consideration for purchase of this property than B did. The gift issue is again not considered in the ruling. Now, in example three, we change that. In example three, we do worry about the fact that there's going to be a gift, and we're going to show one of the things that's been interesting in the RIA newsletter went into some details on was trying to figure out what were the key differences that made the difference in result in example three versus examples one and two. In example three, on April 15th of 2008, A paid the entire $100,000 purchase price of a residence and is the sole owner. Again, it notes the credit's going to be limited to $7,500. Okay, no surprise there. On May 12th, less than a month later, A transfers a one-half interest in the residence to B as a tenant in common in exchange for $10,000. It notes that A can claim the entire credit. But because B acquired the interest in the residence from A in part by gift, B's basis is determined under 1015 by reference to A's basis in the residence. Therefore, the IRS holds B did not purchase an interest in the residence within the meaning of 36C3, and no portion of the credit may be allocated to B because B is not eligible to claim any portion of the credit. Now suddenly a gift arises in this example. The question becomes, what's the key differences between this example and the earlier ones we saw? One key difference to note is the IRS did have some time pass, not quite a month, between the date on which A became the owner of the property and the date on which B transferred the $10,000 and the interest was transferred to B. The question becomes, is the passage of time a key element here, or is the fact that B wasn't a party to the closing the key element here? Not really answered in this ruling on that case. But certainly you could read this, I suppose, to say the passage of time was key, that in essence, if in fact B had outside of closing but on the same date given the $10,000, would the result be different? Potentially. Arguably, you would argue that in fact we just did it for whatever reason because it was easier to close with A. Perhaps A was a person who could qualify for the mortgage easier. There are all kinds of reasons why it worked better having A do it. But in any event, certainly it would seem that the prudent thing to do would be to attempt to have all parties who are going to attempt to claim the credit be parties to the closing, because it appears if both parties put something in the deal and if both parties are on the title at the end of the closing, then we have pretty much carte blanche to allocate the amount of the credit. But if one gets added on later, this example makes clear that at some point when somebody gets added on later, you're not going to be able to claim this credit. Whether that some point is at any point outside the closing or whether that some point is a few days after the closing is not clear. But again, we're going to spend some time paying attention to this example. As is normal, though, the best thing, and it was advice given to me in a course years ago by Paul Merman that was actually raised with regard to an issue involving SARS, an application of SARS to an example that somebody raised in the room about applying a special case. His answer was that he really couldn't give a clear answer as to how that works, but the practical answer was you just don't want to even be in this case where we're going to ask this question in a real-world case. You want to position things so they don't work this way. The same thing for your clients here. You want to try to make sure your clients, to the extent possible, don't end up setting up a situation that looks anything like Example 3, so we're not holding the conversation with the agent about what the relevant points of Example 3 are versus what's not relevant. In example four, we pointed out that maybe what happens if one party, we have this couple that came together, one of whom had owned a home before, the other whom had not, and they now buy a home together. Well, in this case, A and B each contribute $50,000 toward the $100,000 price of a residence, and they own one half as tenant in common. $7,500 is going to be our credit again, and by the way, in most cases these days, even with the drop in housing prices, I suspect in most real-world cases, $7,500 is going to be our limit in many of the, at least even here today in Phoenix, $7,500 is still going to be most likely your limit. B, in this case, though, is not a first-time home buyer. Now, none of the credit can be allocated to B. Okay, that makes sense. He's not going to get anything, he or she. But A can claim the entire $7,500 credit. So conceivably, combining this with example one, A had owned a home for many years, falls in love with B, they get together, they buy a joint home. B's not been a homeowner for the prior 3 years. So we buy a joint home, B puts down $10,000, B puts in $10,000, A puts in $490,000, and supposedly we can still get the full credit to that first-time home buyer, even though, in fact, the other party, the original party to this, A coming in, is going to be selling the original residence and claiming the exclusion from gain, presuming there still is a gain to exclude. Example 5 talks about the allocation where if one person goes over the limit. Well, given example 4 that we had, where if we had somebody ineligible totally because they weren't a first-time home buyer, we could give all the credit to the other party. It shouldn't be surprising to discover that if one party has a lot more income than the other, we can give the entire credit to the lower earner. In this example, A contributed $75,000 and B contributed $25,000 toward the purchase price of a residence, and each owned a one-half interest in the residence as tenants in common. Under this section, again, our credit's going to be limited to $7,500. But A had a modified AGI of $100,000, and B had a modified AGI of $60,000. Because A is more than $20,000 over the cap, any portion of the credit allocated to A would be reduced to zero. They may allocate the entire $7,500 credit to B, who is the one eligible to claim it, who can claim it because his income's lower, because the AGI is less than the 75 threshold and therefore can claim the entire credit. Example 6 changes the facts only slightly, this time to put A not above 95,000, but in this case, the modified AGI for A will be 80,000. Now in this case, as it's noted through the mechanics of this, any credit allocated to A will be reduced by 1/4. So what we can do is rather than allocate the credits evenly to the two and lose part of the credit on A, we can allocate the entire credit to B, who will be subject to no reduction in credit, and that's fully allowable under these rules. And it turns out to be somewhat interesting. It means we don't literally read that provision of not allocating it to somebody who's not eligible to claim it, because it still suggests that we could allocate half the credit to A if we wanted to, but if we do so, we're going to lose part of it. Again, making the reading of that first part, not that it's talking about you can't allocate a credit to somebody, you just can't claim the credit. But if you've allocated it to them, it's not going to go to the one who can claim it then, if you've allocated it the wrong way. Example 7 just goes mainly is doesn't really illustrate much that we didn't already know. More reminds us about the strange rules we have for related parties. In this case, we have A and B who are sisters, each contribute one half of purchase price as tenant in common. They can allocate the credit one half to themselves or split it as they wish, no problem. But they bought the property in this case from their cousin C. They remind us that A, B, and C are not related persons within the meaning of Section 36(c)(5), which limits this credit for those that are related from buying it from a related party. So even though we have a cousin here and they may view themselves as relatives for most purposes and most people in regular conversation would view them as related, the fact they are related in that way does not taint this for these purposes. That's merely a reminder that for purposes of the first-time homebuyer credit, there are some planning opportunities available in transferring properties within a family if you find individuals who are not related in the net sense of related parties. That could be useful if we had a property that, let's say, one cousin was trying to get out from under, couldn't find a buyer. You could have a relative buy the property, a relative who would not be deemed to be a related party when you follow through the strict rules involved with Section 36(c)(5). What's the conclusion about these rulings? Well, bottom line is the ruling gives us a lot of flexibility in allocating the credit for unmarried couples. And since the provisions continue into 2009, this is a matter we're probably going to need to continue talking about with our clients into this coming tax year and consider the issues of covering this matter with a first-time homebuyer's credit. As well, we need to keep an eye on. As you probably are all aware, a number of proposals are making their way through Congress right now. We expect a major stimulus bill to come out once we get the new president sworn in this week. And once we get the Congress working on it, we may find provisions like this extended. So it's very possible that this rule could extend itself out further into the future and may become a continuing factor. It would not surprise me personally to see this provision continued out until we actually see the housing market turn around, which means we could have it for a number of years. Therefore, learning how to properly plan for this provision may prove to be very useful in more than just the short term that it's scheduled right now to be in the law. This has been the Tax Update for January 20th, 2009. As always, the Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Be sure to consider visiting there and subscribing to their newsletters on tax-related matters. This has been the Tax Update.